see what why. So basically, I think if you are a theoretician, and I guess we are putting our theoretician hats on, we theoreticians ask why generally all the time, right? That's what our job is. So why are sensor networks hot now? I mean, sensors have been around for a long time of various kinds. Why are we so interested in sensor networking now? Well, so clearly one reason is because we can do wireless networking now, and we can do it at relatively low cost. So that's just one thing. And then the question is, well, now that we can, what can we do with it? Can we really usefully exploit data from thousands, millions of sensors? Do you really get more from having a network of sensors than from, say, n individual sensors? You could also ask, why lots of sensors? Well, I think that, despite what Greg said this morning, I think it's still of interest, because really, if you're talking about microsensors, your sensing range is not going to be big, and if you're talking about covering large areas, you do need lots of sensors. So I think the theoretician's angle in pretty much any field should be just to think about the big picture issues and shed some light on it, right? I mean, big picture issues such as how does having lots and lots of sensor nodes improve the quality of information we get, not just the quantity? Can we really get data out from lots and lots of nodes? How exactly should these nodes collaborate? Should they be doing distributed source coding, or should they be doing distributed detection, or should they be doing something else altogether? I don't know. And lastly is, it's a very important issue, especially when it comes to, say industrial instrumentation. Can people really trust wireless sensor networks to work, right? I mean, there are all sorts of plants out there that have sensors that are wired up and doing lots of stuff and process control and all that. Would people be willing to go and do, in the next generation, a lot of wireless sensors, or to the extent that actually they rely on them? So those are some of the big picture issues that I think theorists would do well to ponder before formulating problems. And the thing with, and I'm going to give you three examples where we truly did ask big picture questions, and it led to new ideas, which may be good or bad, but at least they're new. And they might lead to somewhere, they might not, but I hope they're at least interesting. So one of the big picture questions that we asked was, how do you really gather information from, say, 100,000, say, a million sensors? And that's what led us to the idea of imaging sensor nets, which a lot of you have heard about a little, so I'll just go through it briefly in this presentation, just to sort of bring out some of the highlights. How do we, we are in the world of homeland security and war, so clearly one question to ask is, how do you track entities, and how do you sort of do surveillance? Clearly, the model that we have of people sitting and looking at screens three different cameras in a building is not going to scale to very, very large, neither large buildings nor large sort of arenas. So basically, how do you do large-scale camera networks, right? That's something I'm not going to talk too much about, because our results there are not sort of fully thought out. But that sort of naturally leads to that question of, what is the next generation now that digital cameras are cheap, now that wireless networking is cheap? Can you really do large-scale camera networks? The other question it led us to is, what can you do if you really, really, really make the sensor functionality minimal? How well can you, for example, track with sensors that just say yes or no? A third big picture question that we are asking is, this is sort of, people have been talking about sort of distributed, cooperative communication, things like that. Can sensors that are in a area really act like a distributed antenna array? And then that led us finally to, after a lot of thinking and iterations, to some practical algorithms for distributed transmit beamforming. So I'm going to give you very brief vignettes of some of these ideas, and then sort of end with some, again, for lack of a better term, philosophy. So minimalism and scale are the themes that I sort of mentioned in the title. Why minimalism? Well, if you want to say scale for to a very large number of sensors, you do need to sort of minimize the amount of work each sensor does, and also you want to make the deployment really easy. You don't want to go around hand placing the sensors in known location. And that's what led us, that's the imaging sensorness I'm going to talk about. Students involved are Bharat, who's in the audience. He's going to be graduating soon, so that's why, that's another reason I must talk about this. Monkyo, who's working, who's basically with my colleague Mark Rodwell in high-speed semiconductor circuits. He's building the prototype related to this work. So that's one thing I'm going to mention. The other, the next topic is scaling in energy. I want to transmit data relatively far away. How can I do it with inter-sensor collaboration, but not all the time sort of communication, right? And so it turns out that distributed transmit beamforming with feedback control is a very interesting approach. Feedback control from the receiver is a very interesting approach for doing this. Raghu is again in the audience, and he's going to be graduating soon, so very good guy. I had to talk about this work because of that. We came up with this idea. Raghu and came up with this idea in collaboration with, I guess, Professor Jean Espania in our controls group, and then later on Ben Wild, who is a student at UC Berkeley under the supervision of Karan Ramchandran, did a prototype of this idea as well. Just a one-shot acknowledgement. And then the final thing that I'm going to talk about scaling is in terms of the sensor cost and functionality. Can you really, and also in terms of the noise that sensors might encounter, what if you want to reduce the observation produced by the sensor down to a binary observation? Yes or no, something is in my vicinity. Can you really do an interesting task like tracking in this context? And again, there's so many names because the first generation of this work was done by Nishit and Raghu. This was in collaboration with Professor Suri, computational geometer in our CS department. And the second generation was done with Jaspreet and Rajesh. So as you can see, you have students involved in sort of various different enterprises, same student in multiple enterprises. So the idea of imaging sensors, and I apologize if you've seen this before, but I guess for the benefit of those who have, I hope I'm not overexposing this work. The basic idea is lots and lots of sensors, randomly dispersed, and they are dumb. They don't know where they are, they can't talk to each other, they just act like pixels, and you can collect data from them in various ways. The thing that we really are focusing on right now in our prototype and such like is collector-driven data collection. A very smart collector comes around, shines beams on segments of the sensor field. The sensors just retro-reflect the beacon around and put data modulation on top of it, just like RFID, except that we're talking about higher ranges. And the collector uses the fact that there's this radar geometry created by the turnaround and a synthetic aperture radar created by sort of overlap of successive beams to localize the sensors. And some they would have to use some sort of multi-user demodulation techniques to sort of deal with the inter-sensor interference when doing data demodulation and localization. So that's one model. The other model is, again, the same thing. You just throw them out, and then the sensors just, and you don't know where they are, and then when the sensors have something to report, they just transmit at will. And there's a network of collectors sitting around, constantly monitoring the sensor network and trying to figure out the location as well as the data transmitted by the sensor. I'm not going to talk, this is more recent work that Bharat has done that I'm not going to talk too much about today. So basically, what we are shooting for is a long life for these sensors, and because basically you'll have wake-up circuitry and things like that also on there. So they just talk when they want to talk or when the collector's beacon shines on them, and very simple functionality, right? And all the sophistication has moved to these collector nodes, right? And the surprising thing about this is that while if you're not amplifying the signal when you turn it around, your range is restricted to sort of 100 meters or so. At most, for the kind of link budgets you have done. But if you give them even 5 milliwatts of transmit power, you can reach up to that scenario of a satellite collector, right? So that makes it very interesting. You can talk all about multi-hopping in that sense of field, but it's not going to get you any closer to the satellite. So really, this is the only way to go for such distant data collection sort of paradigms. And the prototype you're working on is operating at millimeter wave carrier frequencies, 60 gigahertz on up, because that allows you to sort of focus the beam from the collector while not needing a huge antenna, and also allows us to shrink the sensor down, because the sensor antenna can now just be a pattern of metal on circuit board. And of course, the key challenge here is, can you make these millimeter wave sensor transceivers cheap? And so basically, can you implement them in silicon? The collector signal processing is also interesting, but it's not certainly not insurmountable. It's a sort of a blend of standard techniques. And just to give you a picture of what's happening, you just do this. That tells us that I have something to report, talk, and you can see the overlap in the beams, and you can see two sensors talking at the same time, etc. I will not go through the details of the prototype design right now, because I have other, I want to keep this as a vignette, and you can certainly read our papers. One thing to note is, if you have a semi-passive sensor, again, for the millimeter wave link budgets that we have done, you can get 100 meter range, even though you have a 1 over r to the fourth loss, 1 over r squared this way, 1 over r squared that way, because you're not amplifying the signal. Not amplifying is a huge advantage, because then isolation problems between transmitter and receiver go away. But you can get a huge range with a very small transmit power. As far as how do you localize them, ignore the math, but basically the idea is that you have these overlapping beams, so this sensor will have a response in several beams. So its response is sort of a vector in beam space, and also it will have this radar-like geometry that allows you to locate it in the range direction. And then the rest of the math is you just can do some sort of maximum likelihood type processing. When two sensors are pretty close together who are talking, then you can have mistakes. You can miss some of them, but hopefully that should not be too much of a problem if you have fairly correlated observations for a dense deployment. So, but though there are very interesting issues that we have not completely explored as to how best to deal with inter-sensor interference. Just a picture of the prototype so far. This is the collector hardware. This is sort of the millimeter wave RF hardware. That's the antenna. I think I deleted the picture of the blow up of the sensor there. But basically, the sensor, the hardware is right now just done in brass board. But the antenna, for example, is just a pattern of metal on circuit board. And we have verified that the retro reflection works, and that RF delays can be calibrated out. So basically, if you're looking at inducing a radar geometry, you really can do it, because it's a very predictable RF delay in the sensor. So where's the theory here? Well, most of the action right now is in the hardware, right? The sensor IC design, the collector sensor system integration. But there are, we've only touched the surface of getting to efficient algorithms. We certainly have not this is like a giant multi-user detection problem that you don't want to take a direct approach to solving. You have to really somehow take sort of suboptimal and slick approaches to dealing with inter-sensor interference on these returns. Collaboration among collectors, again, it's actually even more critical in the sensor-driven paradigm, and the sensors just talk and the collectors have to collaborate. There we have some interesting Bayesian algorithms, but I think there's a lot more thought that needs to go into that. Then once this stuff is done, how do you, represent data in this context? For collector-driven data collection, when the collector might come by, I don't know, every day maybe, or every so often, what do I do with the data and the sensors, which are supposed to be pretty minimalistic? Sensor-driven, it's relatively easier, but so I don't know whether there's so much thought required there, but we need to think through for some real observations what will happen. And this is, again, not theory, this is more hardware. again, in order to have millimeter wave modes, ultimately, we need to provide interfaces for integrating microsensing functionalities. So why am I talking about this, apart from the fact that I want to publicize Bharat's work because he's going to look for a job? Why am I talking about this in a theory conference? Because I think it was fundamentally a theoretical mindset that led to this idea. Basically, you have to sort of dream about what can you do with a million sensors in order to get to a paradigm like imaging sensor nets. So I really think that theoreticians have a huge role to play in a young field like sensor nets, and that really you have to just innovate as much as possible. All right. Now on to Raghu's work. This is again a very, you know, big picture question. Bunch of sensors, local collaboration, can agree on a message. How do I send it far away efficiently? Wouldn't it be cool if you could all sort of do it so that our radio frequency phases all line up at the receiver? Then I would get basically a factor of n gain in power for n of us collaborating. Moreover, if I can do this, I can use lower frequencies. Typically, lower frequencies, meaning larger wavelengths, require big antennas. But if I can have a lot of us, and which are naturally spaced apart, I'm really synthesizing a giant antenna. And I can use lower frequencies, which give me better propagation also. So can I do that? I can also, of course, have diversity and protection from shadowing if a bunch of us are sending, etc. But can we really line phases up? And it turns out, Raghu came up with a very simple mechanism for, and there are many possible mechanisms you could have for doing this, but the mechanism he came up with was particularly simple. Assume that frequencies are locked, and then basically you're somehow synchronized in terms of your iterations. So all those things are not very critical assumptions. What you want to lock up is phases at the receiver. All of you just try a random phase perturbation from where you are, a small phase perturbation. The receiver just tells you better or worse. If things got better for the receiver, then you keep your phase perturbation. If they got worse, you undo it. So you're sort of on an ascent. And then actually, it turns out, if you just do this very simple algorithm, you can, your phase coherence is achieved, in time linear in the number of nodes, which is the interesting part in terms of theoretically why is it linear? Basically, because you can bound the progress from below that you're making towards the goal of things adding up coherently. And we have a prototype done by Ben Wild at Berkeley, as I said, with a three-node network that actually implements this, and it gets to within 90% of the beamforming gain. So what do you do? How do you understand this very sort of nonlinear type algorithm? And one thing that Raghu started with was to just plot the empirical trajectories of the received signal strength, actually received signal amplitude, that's what that is. Turns out that all of them are sort of almost deterministic. They're following essentially the same path. So we started wondering, can we do an average analysis of what's going on? And it turns out what's happening is, if you have a net resultant vector at the receiver of adding up those phases, which is looking like this, once the phases get perturbed, the net effect is something in this direction and something orthogonal to it. And it turns out that if this vector is long enough, then this part is negligible, and you just have to understand what's going on here. And this is a combination of many different terms, it looks Gaussian, essentially. Many small terms, so it looks Gaussian. And so basically what happens is you can figure out what the variance of this term is. It's a zero mean term, then you can do well. What's happening? You start out with uniform phases. Everybody has uniform phases, and you're gonna converge towards phases that are sort of tightly coupled around something. What is that? If you could figure out what the distribution is of that of the phases of the individual nodes as a function of the number of iterations, you would have the analysis of the algorithm. And so, what what can you say? All you know at a given point is that the received signal strength is this long. Also you know, not knowing anything else, that each of the individual nodes have uniform phases. Based on that, can you say, based on the length, can you say something about the clustering of the phases around some good point? And it's pretty, again, this craziness is all due to Raghu, okay? So this is an analogy with this Boltzmann distribution, by knowing the temperature, you can sort of come up with a distribution for the energies of the individual atoms. Can you, knowing the length of the resultant vector, come up with a distribution for the phases? And you can say, well, the most likely phases, most likely such distribution will be the distribution closest to the uniform while satisfying that constraint, and it comes up to be this kind of exponential cosine distribution, which matches simulation very well. So basically, once you know, once you get a handle on how the phases are going to look as a function of the iterations, you can do all sorts of things. You can predict the trajectory, analytical versus simulated. You can optimize the, should we do large phase perturbations at the beginning? Obviously we should, and then reduce the phase perturbations as we go along. So you get that. And you can also say that, see, that as the number of sensors gets large, the time amount of time to get to, say, 80% of the beamforming gain, 75% of beamforming gain, all of them are straight lines. So convergence is linear in the number of nodes. You can show all those things. So to end this vignette, because I still want to, you know, tell you about one more thing. Where are we at? We have sort of standard trade-offs of, okay, suppose now the channel to the receiver is varying. How well can you track the channel, so that which means you perturb things fast, versus what's your misadjustment, basically? How closely can you approach the true value? What kind of protocols could leverage this distributed beamforming, which is clearly not just restricted to sensor networks? This was not truly distributed in the sense that there's a centralized, very economical centralized feedback that's tying everybody together. Can you use this kind of paradigm in other kinds of distributed control tasks? So these are some of the open issues that come up based on the, at least to my mind, based on the work so far. On to the last vignette, again to do with minimalism and scale. Again, we have sensors are just saying yes or no, some target is within my vicinity or not. How else can I do? What are the fundamental limits? How can we represent the paths that for the targets that are going through the sensor field? And it turns out that efficient geometric algorithms together with probabilistic algorithms play a very key role. So a quick idea of the geometry. Quick idea of the geometry, just think of three sensors with disks as their sensing range. As the target goes through, X will go high and then low when the target exits, and Y and then Z, etc., right? And so communication-wise, it's a pretty economical model. You can just say the times at which you went high and low and do some averaging internally to the sensor so that you're not doing that too often, right? So that's, in terms of geometry, by basically intersecting the yes and no's, you can get these localization patches in which you can isolate the targets at various times. And also by looking at when the transitions are happening, you can sort of say, again, this is in a very idealized thing, right? You can say which arcs are being crossed by the target, right? So that's the basic geometry of the situation. So what can you say based on that geometry? It turns out that if you have just a single target, you can say that you can localize it in two dimensions to something that's inversely proportional to the product of the sensor density and the sensing range. Okay, so basically, as long as you're covering the entire field of interest, you can trade off density versus range. The other thing is that the binary model is sort of like A to D conversion, and so and there's some sort of low-pass filtering that's happening. So if you're wiggling around in the sensor's range, can't tell the difference. Once you have these kinds of things, that motivates sort of a very minimal representation for this target spot too. Since you can't tell anything about wiggles, why have wiggles at all? You just have piecewise linear representations that are easy to compute, and from that derive simple velocity estimates, which for just the low pass version of the path. So forget the wiggles, just look at the averaged trajectory. And then all this was done with very sensitive sort of geometric algorithms. Once the sensors start sort of not being so nice, then you need to use some probabilistic techniques such as a particle filter that will give you outputs that are not sort of nice straight lines, but then you can use geometric techniques to clean it up. Then we come to, so this was all done, this is in a census paper, census 2006, all done only for a single target because we didn't even understand that when we started, right? Then the moment you come to multiple targets, there's a real problem. I mean, if a sensor is lit up, is it because of one target, two targets, three targets? With this model, you don't know, right? So that's just a trivial example, but in general, there are many possible explanations if you just take a snapshot of the sensor readings. What can you do? So basically, the first thing Subhash did when he looked at how well can we count sensors? And it turns out you can't really give too many guarantees. You can come up with some minimal number of targets that satisfy your current snapshot, but you can't really give algorithms for the evolution of the target spots. But it turns out the moment you put in probabilistic techniques like particle filters and assume some sort of smoothness in the paths, you can actually, even with just this binary minimalistic sensing model, you can do a pretty good job of temporal evolution. So let me just give you some pictures in the last few minutes just to show you, okay, what's behind this work. The first part is, how do you get these resolution theorems? Simply by bounding the size of these localization patches. And you can sort of say that the maximum patch size is at least this much for any deployment. And even for a Poisson, just throw them down kind of deployment, your average patch size is of the order of this 1/density times range thing. So that's how you get your resolution theorems. In terms of the Occam track algorithm that gives a piecewise linear thing, it's just a greedy algorithm that stabs as many of these localization arcs as possible, goes as long as possible. Spatial low-pass filtering, you can actually give a very direct analogy to level crossing A to D converters for a 1D geometry. We don't have such a precise analogy for two dimensions, but clearly you can see that you can't deal with that, so you might as well deal with some simple, either spline or piecewise linear representation. Once you have that, you get to velocity estimation. How well can you estimate velocity? Well, even if you restrict yourself to sort of so-called low-pass versions of the path that are just sort of straight lines within these localization patches, even then you can have up to a factor of two difference in velocity estimates between, say, this path and this path, which correspond to the same sensor readings. And the only way around it is to sort of hypothesize about the path. The path is going to be well approximated by a line for long enough for you to get an accurate velocity estimate. So you have to do things like that. And once you do things like that, even for sort of randomly generated waypoint type models and such and variations thereof, you can get a pretty good, Occam track gives you a pretty good output. And the velocity estimates are within the designed 10% error rate. And simulations and the resolution limits are pretty close. And well, non-ideal sensing, the way we handle it, I'll just say, you can handle it by saying, let's have a very simple model for non-ideal sensing. An acoustic sensor, for example, could give you pretty nasty results, but at least you can say this, beyond a certain range, it'll say no. And before a certain range, it's pretty, it's gonna say yes. So you can put sort of two circles saying, outside this circle, I'll certainly say no. Inside the circle, I'll certainly say yes. So if I'm saying no, that means I'm outside the inner circle. If I'm saying yes, I'm inside the outer circle. And then you use the same sort of geometric, do the same sort of intersections to get those localizations. And experimental results with modes and acoustic sensors will give you promising results, but let me go on to the multiple I want to go on to the multiple targets. I just wanted to show you just a picture of sensors in 1D, and those arc intervals are showing the coverage area of sensors, right? So if some sensors are on and some others are off, you can intersect the regions and say that targets lie in this vicinity. But this is a pretty big region, right? Pretty big uncertainty that you get from a snapshot, and you don't even know whether it's one target or two targets in this vicinity. But then, if you start putting particles in these intervals, and in these spatial intervals, and joining them as you evolve in time, and then dumping them according to some criteria of non-smoothness, then you can do pretty well, not only with sort of constant velocity paths or acceleration paths, and as long as things are smooth, you're not that bad in terms of the particle filter. You can even deal with non-ideal sensing with similar models. You might actually have a few more particles than paths, and maybe deal with it at some other level if you want to be conservative about not losing any paths. So you can do that. And these are experimental results with passive IR sensors along a corridor. Not bad in terms of the results you get. So the I guess what I'm looking for now in this, if one is to pursue this binary sensing framework, is there a nice signal processing framework for it? I mean, can you really make this spatial low-pass filtering angle more precise? Can you really sort of say that multiple targets create some sort of interference that you have to resolve in some way? Can we get a sort of more systematic framework, understand the particle filtering stuff better? In terms of practical aspects, clearly you want to enhance the binary model. The binary model is sort of a bedrock. That's the lowest you can go. How do you take that and then build on it? Can you sort of have a Bayesian framework for combining multimodal sensors? And then the other thing is, because of the economy of the communication model, we really didn't focus on the communication at all. We just said everything is centralized somewhere, all the information from the sensors. But clearly, distributed realizations are interesting to look at. So those were, again, three examples of research resulting from big picture questions. So I wanted to just end with a big picture, which is my big picture. And this is very, very opinionated. I think what's needed for sensor nets to be a success is two or three successes in terms of applications, meaning something that everybody can point to and say, hey, this really worked. Okay. I'm not sure it's there yet, but if one could focus on some things that one believes in and make that happen, I think that would be a very, very interesting thing for the field. And I really think that something that theorists do better than anybody else is to ask sort of big picture questions and do thought experiments, and then follow up with answers, and then you really, nowadays it's more, I think the barriers between disciplines are relatively low. It's relatively easy to collaborate with experimentalists and builders if one has a good idea. And I gave three examples of research resulting from big picture questions. But again, these questions sound almost trivial, but if one takes them seriously in terms of how best to use sensor correlations in a practical way, I think they would lead to very interesting answers. How to provide guarantees so that people would be confident about using sensor nets, wireless sensor nets, what are good architectures for surveillance, etc. So I'll just stop there.